Yeah, that was Sister Katie Brown.
Amen.
She wanna fly away. Amen. Amen. You know, we're down to about a minute.
Yes, sir.
And it's been a wonderful time, guys. I've enjoyed it. And you know what? I sure hope you guys will come back again. And come and chat with us. And Kiana, I really, really like your perspective. You talked about more behind the scenes about your walk with Christ, how you changed, how you come from being a Catholic into Christianity and understanding things. And I'd love for you to come back and share some of it sometime, okay?
I just want to quickly say thank you, brother. Thanks for having us on here. And just real quick, hey, if you think that you have to clean up your life before you have to come to Christ, don't do it. Just come to Christ, man.
Amen, amen. I'll see you next week. Remember the Pep House tonight, 8 to 10 p.m. on KBOO
Amen.
Portland.
Have a blessed day.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Good morning and welcome to Pathways. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Every Sunday morning at this time, we invite you to join us for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. Today on Pathways, we are talking with Paul Hawken, author of Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. Paul Hawken is an environmentalist, entrepreneur, journalist, and best-selling author of 6 previous books. He is the architect and leading proponent of reform with respect to ecological practices. And starting at the age of 20, he has dedicated his life to sustainability and changing the relationship between business and the environment. Good morning, Paul, and welcome to Pathways.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Blessed Unrest is described in your press kit as the story of what is going right in the world. Yet, I find that to be a very interesting book title. Can you explain that for us?
The book actually goes back years and years. It goes back 13, 14 years ago when I was giving speeches, and afterwards people would come up and give me their cards from their organizations. We would swap them, and I would put them in my pockets and take them home and put them in a drawer. And one day the drawer was so full that my person who would take care of my houseboat would dump them in a big bag, big shopping bag from Bergdorf Goodman, and put it in my closet. And that bag started to fill up. And when it was full, I decided that I should find out how many organizations there were in the world addressing social justice and the environment. Okay, switch to 1999, and I'm in Seattle, and November 30th, and the WTO demonstrations. And I didn't go there to write, I went there to participate. But after I left and went to Washington, where I was giving a non-related talk, I read the Post and the New York Times and the LA Times. I read what people were writing about it, and it was so erroneous and so off that I decided to write a piece about it, which I did. And in the process, I was researching how Seattle was organized. And the organizational meme, if you will, or the scheme, I guess, really went back to 1990 and 1992, to the encuentros that were organized by the First Peoples of North, Meso, and South America. It was the first time that the First Peoples had gotten together as a group since the conquest in 500 years. And they use a Mayan social organizational technology, if you will, which was used in Seattle. So then we had two things going on. One is my pursuit of how many groups there were. And then I began to realize that that there was something sort of permeating this movement on a global level that really wasn't talked about. And I went through and I decided to write a book. And the first title was Uprising, which I tossed when 9/11 happened. And then it was The Forgotten, The Excluded, and The Uninvited, which was poetic, but a little doer. And then there was the other, Superpower, which had bravura, but then I realized quickly, who needs another one? In fact, one is too many. And then there was the title, We Interrupt This Empire, which at least had humor. But finally, I was in Namibia 2.5 years ago doing a photo shoot, and I read a quotation by Martha Graham to Agnes DeMille, who had come to New York, seen a show that she had choreographed and won awards for 6 months prior, and had fallen apart. She was so dismayed. And Martha Graham turned to her and said, Agnes, we are artists. We are never satisfied. There's this queer dissatisfaction, this blessed unrest that makes us march and makes us more alive than the others. And when I read that, I just felt like I had found the title that had arms big enough to hold the diversity and the breadth and the scope of this movement without saying what it was.
Beautiful. You know, we said in our introduction that starting at the age of 20, you dedicated your life to sustainability, etc. Yet you were a very successful businessman, and I'm wondering whether there was a conversion experience at some point. How did Blessed Unrest come to you, or was it there from the very beginning?
I grew up in California. I grew up in the Sierra Club. I grew up with a environmental awareness, and I went into business to direct business to the environment, not to... I just thought, well, business was a useful vehicle.
Right.
And it was with some, actually, reluctance that I went into business. I'm not a big fan of business, actually. And I have succeeded in it, but it's never compelled me. It's not something that I want to, you know, sort of on my epitaph, you know, it's like I say, he was a good businessman. I would, you know, like, me, gone.
So do you think that the capitalistic system of business is inherently wrong?
Well, that's a really, really big question.
I mean, is it inherently exploitive?
We are. Let's go back, okay. Because we talk about a system, and why do we create a system that basically says that if we steal from the future and sell it in the present, we can call it a profit? I mean, how is it that we created an economic system that does not maintain the earth in real time and calls it economic growth? I mean, those are questions we have to all answer. I mean, it's really within us. The system itself is a manifestation of who we are. And I'm not saying that the system itself would change if each person changed, or maybe if they all changed. But all I'm saying is that we talk about it as if it was outside of us, and when in fact it's inside of us. And, you know, greed is a universal human, you know, emotion, and none of us is without it in some way or another. So we do have an economic system that is pathological, neurotic, and bizarre, and we don't have to look far to figure out how it got that way. The capitalist system, really, the fundamental flaw, really, is that money has a higher value than people, which is the rights of money, the rights of capital, really supersede and take precedence over a child, a forest, a human being, a mother, a farmer. And as we know as directors and fiduciaries, the fact is that if we are in charge of a pile of money, and then we have a legal and fiscal responsibility to make sure that nothing happens to that money. But the same corporation that has that fiscal responsibility does not have a responsibility to maintain the viability of ecosystems, riparian corridors, or children, or factory workers in China, etc. So there's a great, great, not just imbalance, but actually a kind of perverse reversal of the priorities and the values that really we uphold as human beings in community. And when they aggregate out into corporations, into a capitalist system, our values get splayed.
Yeah, I read somewhere that a CEO of a public corporation that does not look to profits in such a way that maybe the company dedicates some resources to sustainability or the environment, that that's actually illegal.
Well, he could be liable in some ways, and so it places the onus on CEOs to make always a business case for sustainability.
Right, exactly.
Right, absolutely,
exactly.
Yeah.
Now, in your book, Blessed Unrest, you point out that the 21st century, there's two remarkable developments. There are systemic problems that are global in nature, and in response to that, there's the arising of a movement.
Mm.
Can you explain?
Well, the systemic problems are that the environmental issues that we're well familiar with are becoming global, whether they're oceans and the die-off of the coral reefs or the rise of climate change as a pressing issue. At the same time, what we're seeing is a bottom-up movement that's being not organized, but it's organizing itself, that is in every country, every culture, every city, every language, every tribe in the world. It consists of between 1 and 2 million organizations. It consists of over 100 million people. And it is the humanity's immune response to political corruption, economic disease, and ecological degradation. And it's arising because the response of the institutions that are normally empowered to monitor and care for the commons and the things that we share as communities, as a civilization, as culture, have failed miserably. So the salient issues of our time and poverty and inequities and climate change are actually being booted, and they are not being dealt with by governments. And so you see an explosion of non-governmental organizations rising up to correct the imperfections and the failings of government. Government is failing because it doesn't represent us. It represents money, and money is coming from business. So we have a massive corrupting of a democratic process that is actually goes back ages. It's not new, but it's certainly reached an apex right now in the world, just at a time when the problems caused by that corruption are getting so serious and so pressing that people need to respond, and respond they are. And as I said, it's not just the largest movement in the world, it's the largest movement in history. Nothing like it has ever existed before. It's an unnamed movement. It's a movement that doesn't even know it's a movement. And the reason we don't see this movement is because it acts like no other movement we've ever seen, which is it doesn't have white, charismatic, vertebrate leaders. It doesn't have ideologies. It is not about amalgamating power. Most social movements in the past were about amalgamating power, seeing an imbalance and getting some for themselves. This movement is about the dispersion of the pathological concentrations of power that we see in the world. So we see the movement as powerless, but there is this fierce, deep courage that you see in people and organizations throughout the world that are really challenging the overwhelming corruption that we see in our super international institutions, our transnational corporations, and our governments.
You know, you mentioned the good of the commons, and it's always struck me as odd that as intelligent as one has to be to organize or run a major enterprise, such as a business, that there is such a denial of the law of the commons. I mean, I just can't even fathom that. And that must be the wicked stepchild of this corruption that you're talking, this greed that you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, we called things commonwealths, you know, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, for example, the Virginia Commonwealth. And so there was embedded at the time of the creation of the colonies a really strong sense of the commons. And there was a real clear sense that the commons were not something that could be privatized. And of course, what we're seeing now is a worldwide effort to not only privatize the commons, but to corporatize them and to corporatize things that we never even thought were in the commons, such as air and water. I mean, we thought they were in the commons, but we never imagined that anybody could actually own them and resell them to us. And this is also being resisted mightily and muchly by people all over the world. They're seeing in this sort of globalization of resources, they're seeing basically corporations come in and buy, take over, usually again by corrupt practices through an existing sitting government, resources that have been commonly held by indigenous people, tribes, cultures, or just regionally without any one culture having, you know, primacy over that.
Maybe there's a silver lining behind that kind of overreaching. It really gets so, it's just so far-fetched that it mobilizes people.
It is mobilizing. What we see is that there's about 4,000 or 5,000 really indigenous peoples and languages in the world that are sitting on about 20% of the Earth's landmass that are really the last sanctuaries of untouched forests and water, and many minerals and oil deposits are there. And And you're seeing now, in a sense, these are very, in some cases, very difficult places to get to, difficult places to explore in, if you will, difficult places to even live in for corporations. But you're seeing, in a sense, this last assault on the Earth's resources. So I say that this movement consists of the environmental movement, the social justice movement, and the indigenous movement. All three together are morphing and intertwining. And we tend to see the social justice and the environmental movement as separate. But really, both address the same thing, and they address a political economic system that basically is stealing the future and selling it in the present. And so whether you steal a forest in British Columbia or whether you steal the lives of children or workers in China that are being exposed to toxic materials and being underpaid and exploited, you basically have foreclosed a future for those people and other people to come. And so what we're seeing now is that in these movements, they realize that not only does corruption cause poverty, that poverty causes resource demands and exploitation, which causes more poverty, which causes deracination of cultures, which move to large urban centers, which are then exploited by globalized companies that need cheap, inexpensive labor, which drives low prices, which drives consumerism, which drives the use of fossil fuels, which drives climate change, which drives, it keeps going. And so what we're seeing now, and you can see this on wiserearth.org, when you look under the sort of the taxonomy, if you will, of this movement, you can see how these organizations are realizing that even though they may address specific hurts and causes and solutions in the world, that really we can't treat the symptoms because it's a system that we need to treat. And if we start to connect and coordinate ourselves in that way, we're starting to be a systemic solution as opposed to a symptomatic one.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like the challenge of sustainability is related to the imperative of the capitalistic structures to grow or die. I always thought, why is that necessary? I mean, if you can figure out a way to offer a service or produce something that's useful, why do you have to keep growing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, right now we grow by stealing the future, but you could just as easily grow by healing the future. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because if we look at how corporations are valued on the stock market, they're actually valued because they invest in the future. They have IP, intellectual property. They have a brand. They have a really well-educated and well-cared-for workforce. They have an R&D function and facility that's developing a stream of products and ideas that will be commercialized in the future. So we know that we look at an individual corporation that that's what we want. Somehow, we've turned that upside down when we look at our collective future, and that is that we in a sense think, or we're convinced that the only thing we can do to make money is to take from the future and to translate it into a current balance sheet. But in fact, we can sort of turn this sock inside out, and there's no reason we can't have companies and institutions that basically do the same thing that corporations do individually, but that we can do collectively, which is to heal the damage that has been done, because that is creating value. And that has a present value and it has a future value. And we can just as easily have an economy that grows by using less and less and creating more and more for the future. Either way is possible.
You know, these globalized environmental problems that we've been talking about might have a silver lining too, in the sense that they basically bring the law of the commons to the forefront of everybody's consciousness. Global environmental catastrophe is not good for business. Not a risk worth taking. What do you think of that?
In the last 2 years, something has really shifted, and I can tell because of not only who calls me, but what they say. And in the past, CEOs of such corporations, large Fortune 50, 100 companies, sometimes would call, but it was really about solving a problem, getting something off their back, you know, getting rid of a nagging issue that was basically hurting their reputation. And what you see now is, or what I've seen, is people calling and realizing that we have a problem, and we is the big we. It's not just that company. And there's a genuine inquiry as to what should we do? What can we do? Who should I talk to? They're not looking for fixers. They're not looking to greenwash. They're actually looking to reposition and to become responsible in increasing ways. And this is a real, real important sea change that we're seeing. Some of it is being done and sort of mangled by corporate communications and looks kind of greenwashy, but the underneath this is actually a group of people who understand that something fundamentally has changed in the world and that they need to adopt and change as well.
And this movement is part of what's changing in the world that you're writing in the book, Blessed Unrest, about. How can a movement really succeed if it doesn't have a name or a leader or a center?
Because everything we're seeing right now has been brought about by this movement. Those the very changes we see in the Rupert Murdochs and the Walmarts and the General Electrics have been brought about through years and years and years of work of publicity, of science, of education, of promulgation, of views, of information about our environment, about our situation in terms of social conditions. And oftentimes this movement isn't given credit for what it does, but if you actually just go outside, you go into the city of Portland, you walk around, you look at what the city does in the parks and everything, what you're seeing is everywhere. It's ubiquitous, except we take it for granted. The initiatives, the changes, what's happening here with respect to sustainability and transportation and building codes and materials and how it's organized and how it's run and the values and land use and so forth. All this came about because of non-profits, you know, non-governmental institutions. Once it pervades and is taken up by another institution, we tend to sort of forget its origins. So this movement will succeed when the ideas that it promulgates really has permeated all of society, as opposed to it will succeed when it's in power. It doesn't want power, it wants change. It's a movement of ideas, and ideas are only as good as they work. They don't work, you toss them, you try a new idea. It's really a movement about solutions. It's a movement about process and dialogue, about opening up, about recreating community, about recreating resiliency in our communities with local food webs and local transport systems, and the willingness to stop importing our lives from others and creating a world without fear, wealth without plunder, you know, work without exploitation. And this is what it's about. And it's actually is succeeding. And when I go back to that sort of analogy of immune system, we have to remember that the immune system lags the disease. It doesn't happen in real time. That would be autoimmune, and that would kill you.
Right.
Yeah.
So this movement's happening. Obviously, you think it's important to let people know about it. You've written this book, Blessed Unrest, about it, describing it, explaining it to people. To what extent are you going to be considered a leader of this movement?
Well, I think if you read the book, and I'm just assiduous, I think, or fastidious about sort of not doing what you see occasionally, and that is sort of people grabbing a baton and putting on sort of a spangly suit and getting in front of the parade. There is no one parade anyway. What we're trying to do here with wiserearth.org and the book and then a documentary eventually is really hold a mirror up to the movement and say, look, this is who you are. When my children were young, I used to read them a book called Are You My Mother? You know, about this little duckling that goes around looking at steam shovels and policemen and trying to figure out who its mother is. But this movement has a mother, and it goes really way back to the age of religiosity, to the actual age, to Buddha, Mencius, Confucius, Lao Tzu, Socrates, Rabbi Hillel, you know, Jeremiah. I mean, this movement has deep, deep, deep moral roots. And that is when simultaneously in different parts of the world, this idea of the golden rule emerged, that you never, ever did anything that you wouldn't have done to yourself, to anyone else. You never did that. And that meant any, and that included people you didn't know, you know, that weren't part of your tribe. And along with that came this sense of that all life is sacred, whether it's a child or a creature or a culture. And that start, that beginning of understanding has traced itself through centuries and centuries, you know, and then emerged in the abolitionist movement in 1787, and then reemerged again or simultaneously in the transcendentalist movement and so forth, and now is spreading everywhere in the world, so that you have people organizing themselves to take care of people whom they will never know, for which they will never receive a direct benefit. And this is a historic change in humanity. And what we're trying to do with wiserearth.org is create an information commons where it can see itself, but we're not trying to brand it. We're not trying to organize it. We're trying to walk its talk and our talk, which is to be a community The site is community-owned, it's community-driven, it's open source. You can write your, you know, publish the API. It will soon will become Wiser Business and Wiser Government. Wiser stands for World Index of Social and Environmental Responsibility. We have organizations now, 105,000 in every country of the world. And you can then go do personal profiles, look at jobs and events and things related to your areas of focus or the interest, and connect with people. But just as importantly, we think we're trying to create kind of a, in a sense, an aquifer here. You know, in other words, an infrastructure in which this movement can see and connect to itself. Because I think it is time, without leadership in the overriding sense, but leadership in the bottom up sense, for this movement to start to collaborate and connect much more closely and vigorously, because it isn't like we have a lot of time left.
What do you think we should call it?
I don't know what it'll be named. The Industrial Revolution wasn't named for over 100 years after it started. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It didn't stop anybody from doing it. Mm-hmm. And it will be generations from now, I think, that they'll look back and then name what this was. And I suspect that anybody who tries to name it now is kind of on a fool's errand.
We only have a few minutes, and it's really gone by fast, and we could go for forever. I mean, this is such a fascinating topic. We're so honored to have you here. So in the category of last thoughts, is there a single thing that you can recommend that individuals can do to create a better, healthier, or more just world?
Well, like I said, I mean, I think we're seeing a profound shift in the 21st century from a world created by privilege and the privileged, which has been doing that for hundreds and hundreds of years, to a world created by community. And what people can do is connect into each other and to the things that they love. What the world now needs is to be loved. And that's not something you can teach, really. It's something you can embody. And rather than just bemoan what it is that we're losing and to be worried about it, what we need to do is actually actively love the things that we are losing or that we cherish. And those can be children in poverty, they can be places in the mountains, they can be neighbors that we love. I mean, the fact is that we can't organize a movement that's based on fear, because it will not grow effectively. It has to be based on something much deeper and more profound in order to be not just successful, but to be something that draws us in together. You know, when we see somebody who's hurt on the side of the road, we don't ask who they voted for, what religion they are, anything like that. And I feel that the pressing concerns that the 11th Hour and other documentaries are talking about will actually bring us together, and that we're going to realize that the things that separate us are in most cases irrelevant to the things that unite us and the values that bring us together.
You mentioned wiserearth.org.
Yes.
Is there any other website that you'd like to mention before we have to go?
Well, that's the main one. I mean, there is a website for the book, blessedunrest.com. But I think the most important one is the website in which people can log on, participate, edit, amend, add, create. In other words, they can create a function and utility for themselves and for others around the world, and they can meet people in the same way. It's only 24 days old, so you know, you're getting in on the ground floor, so to speak. It's about 900 people and 105,000 organizations. We seeded it with organizations, and now people are starting to come on, so it's only been out for...
Well, thank you for your work, and thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure. We've been talking with Paul Hawken, author of the new book, Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. And it's for sale at all the finer bookstores in Portland. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in this Sunday morning, and hopefully every Sunday at this time, for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation at www.divination.com. On behalf of KBOO...
listening to KBOO Portland.
It's the month of love, so let's celebrate the love of the blues and the legend Willie Mae Thornton, a.k.a. Big Mama Thornton. Tune in Friday, February 13th at 8 p.m. with me, Katie Zip, to rejoice in